Hello, and welcome to this episode of Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. This is the podcast where I, Lydia, talk all about music, all about my own musical interests. I'm currently conducting research as a PhD student at the University of Michigan. So I do a lot of Black music research. I'm interested in music pedagogy, what are we passing down to our students pedagogically. I'm also an opera singer, so I have experience as a Black woman in classical music. And I have guests on the show to talk about what they do in music, everything from performing music, writing music, teaching, or music production. And today, as we make our way through our fall season with new episodes coming out on Mondays, I'm so excited to introduce my guest, Dr. Michael Buckler. Dr. Buckler is a professor of music theory at Florida State University, and he's also the current president of SMT, the Society for Music Theory. We talk all about how he got started in music. We talk about his research on musical theater and specifically his research intersecting music and labor movements and unions. And we also chat all about the society and what he does as the president of the Society for Music Theory and some of the happenings that will commence next month at our annual meeting in Denver. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of the podcast. We are in the middle of our October-November season. We're gearing up for our annual meeting for SMT in November, and I'm really, really excited to introduce today's guest. He's the president of SMT and also at Florida State University, right?
Yes.
And we're going to talk to him all about his time as president of SMT and his research. Today we have Dr. Michael Buckler on the show. Michael, how are you?
I'm great. So nice to be on your chair, Lydia. Thank you for including me.
Thank you so much for being willing to speak to me today. I'm really excited to hear more about your work and your research and everything that's going on at SMT. So I have so many questions. I will narrow it down, I promise.
Ask me anything.
Oh, great. Listeners, that's what we like to hear. All right. So let's start off. Actually, I always like to start off by talking about how I come to be introduced to the guests. So I remember we had briefly met at the Theorizing African American Music Conference, and that was the first time that we had met in person. How did you enjoy that conference?
Yes, that was a great to meet you there. Great to hear you sing there. For those listeners who have never heard Lydia sing, she's spectacular. So that was the first time I laid eyes on you, I think, was at that opening recital. Like, I think on the first day of the conference.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Yeah. The conference was wonderful. I was really glad that I went. I learned a tremendous amount. It was interesting in so many ways. I mean, Dwight Andrews' keynote was fantastic. It's the first time I've been at a conference, I think, where I, as a white guy, was in the minority. And that was a very, very new experience. And I felt there was a joy to the conference. And there was also a sense of, I think, what we've been missing from our field, as Phil Ewell talks about in quite good detail.
Yeah, it was a really, really cool experience. That was actually my first in-person conference ever. So it was a very, it was a very new experience for me in general. But previous to that point, obviously because of the pandemic, I'd only been to like virtual gatherings. I think my first SMT was 2020 virtually. Yeah, so it was just great to gather in person. It was great to have that live music element. It was great that there were a mix of talks and lecture recitals, and you know, it was just a really versatile conference overall in terms of the mediums that were presented, which I loved.
It was, and it was a great size, so you could actually talk to everybody.
Yes.
Just a really collegial conference, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and start off our conversation talking about you and your background in music. So if you could inform me and the listeners about where you're from and the music that was happening and the place where you're from when you were born, and then if you came from a musical family, kind of the music that was happening in your family, all of that stuff.
Oh, sure. Stop me if I go on too long. But
please, please.
So I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, where we met at that conference. Great. That was like right in my backyard.
Oh, wonderful. Cleveland was lovely. That was my first time in Cleveland, too. That was really nice.
I did my prep work at the Cleveland Institute of Music, at least in high school I did. Before that, I started with private teachers. But my parents are not musically trained at all. I don't come from academics. My grandmother was a good kind of hack pianist, sort of like barroom music a little bit. She played a little bit of classical music. She was my introduction. And when I was, just a few years old, she would babysit me at her apartment, and she had an upright piano, and she would sit me down and teach me how to plink out popular tunes like 5 Foot Two, Eyes of Blue from the teens, Tin Pan Alley stuff. And so like popular music from a century ago. So I learned that way. I've never been an accomplished pianist, but just a kind of functional, I like to, you know, plink out things in my classes. And I started playing trombone in high school, actually euphonium before that, and was in the band and the jazz band and did all of the musical things. My influences growing up, I was exposed to classical music early, thanks to my grandmother. And I was lucky to grow up very close to Severance Hall. You saw how close Severance Hall is to Case Western Reserve. It's just right there. Mm-hmm. And so the Cleveland Orchestra was the only orchestra I knew. We would go out to Blossom Music Center as their summer home, a little like Tanglewood, for summer concerts and picnic. And so I heard a lot of orchestra music growing up, which meant that my knowledge of sort of the 19th century orchestral canon was what I was, you know, my formative experiences. But also, the Metropolitan Opera used to tour to Cleveland. And from the time I was old enough to go to an opera, my first opera was Magic Flute. They always did one matinee that was appropriate for kids, like Hansel and Gretel or Magic Flute or, you know, one of those. And my parents would take me once a year to the opera. I also was lucky that my parents took me to traveling shows in musical theater when they came into town. And not just like the traveling shows that would come, the professional level shows, but a lot of community theater. There were several good community theaters, one outdoor theater that was close to my home that we went to, and that gave me an early exposure to musical theater, which was also really formative. But nothing that I ever imagined studying. I guess I'll talk about that in a little bit. So anyway, I like doing music. I don't think I had much of a plan. I really admired my band director, my orchestra director in high school, and I thought, that's what I want to be. And so I went off to college. I went to Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, largely because it was the best public institution in my state. And I didn't have money to go to private school, and honestly, I probably didn't have grades in high school to go to a fancy school. I wasn't much of a student in high school, I confess. I spent all my time in the band room and escaped classrooms.
You were a student of music. You were a student of music.
I was a student of music, right.
You were an artiste.
I don't know if I was an artiste. But I was thinking I'd be a music ed major, and that's where I started. I wasn't long into my time at Cincinnati that I thought we went out to other schools, and I saw that I didn't know how privileged I was growing up. Like, I didn't know how good I had it in my high school, which was very close to Severance Hall. I had a couple of friends whose parents were in the orchestra. We had a really good school orchestra. And I didn't realize also like discipline problems that K-12 teachers deal with. And I sort of didn't see myself there. And I also started getting interested. I loved my music theory classes in undergrad. And I thought, that sounds fun. And I changed my major to music theory. And I sort of blithely thought, I didn't know what to do after high school, after college. And I applied for a master's in music theory. Michigan took me. So I wound up
where you are,
in Ann Arbor. Go Blue. I think when I landed at Michigan, I truly had no idea what music theory was. For me, it was like a labeling, you know, it was like all labeling. Like I was really, really good at putting Roman numerals on chords and finding all the notes in a row. And it was like, I can complete these tasks, I can do this, but I don't think I had much of a sense of the sophistication of the field. And one of the things that I'm thinking about a lot now is how little our students may understand what music theory actually is. And something that I've been working toward, we can talk about that later if you like, but I had a very narrow idea of the field. Mm-hmm. And even in grad school, I was at Michigan for 2 years, and then I went to the Eastman School of Music for my doctorate. And there too, I mean, I got great training. I mean, in all of the things that one did, this was 88, I went to Michigan, and 90, I went to Eastman. And I had a great cohort of students. I loved my time at Eastman, but I also realized that, you know, we studied a lot of German music, almost no Italian music. I realized thinking in my own curriculum that I never, for example, had an assignment due anywhere through my education on Verdi, an analysis assignment on Verdi or Rossini or Puccini. So like Italian opera wasn't part of the canon.
Yeah.
Much less a lot of other things that weren't part of the canon. And so when it came time to write a dissertation, I sort of stumbled on my dissertation topic almost by accident. The grad students, when we took the comps, we were just expected to know the field. And the field of music theory was a lot smaller than it is now.
Sure.
I mean, the stereotype is often Schenker sets and history of theory. And that's kind of the way our comps were set up. We would have one tonal analysis day, one atonal analysis day, and a day of sort of miscellaneous that centered around history of theory. And I really liked working with atonal music. I loved working with Andy Mead at Michigan, who's now at Indiana, and with Bob Morris, who's about to retire from Eastman, who's my dissertation advisor. And so I was a very set theoretical dissertation, and I thought of another way of comparing the similarity of two sets that you pulled out. I wasn't in love with my dissertation topic, which isn't so bad. I mean, dissertations are good to get done.
Sure.
but if I had been honest with myself, I would have loved to work on musical theater. Or opera. Those were the two things that I think I felt most passionately about growing up. But it's not that anybody ever told me I couldn't study musical theater. I never asked the question because it was just never in front of me, right? Like nobody had written an article on musical theater that was in music theory. I think that's true. I think nobody. And certainly not in the journals that we were expected to read. And so I did my, you know, set theoretical dissertation. I got a couple of articles on it. After that, I got a job at University of Iowa. And I was there for 5 years, and then at Indiana University for only 1 year, because Florida State University had two equal tenure track jobs. Piece of the story that I left off is that at Michigan, the one really great thing that I got out of Michigan was I met my spouse there, Nancy Rogers, who was also a master's student and who also did her doctorate at Eastman. And along the way through our PhD program, we got married. And so she was teaching at Lawrence University in Wisconsin, and I was at Indiana, and they had two jobs for us at Florida State. So south we went. And along the way, I got a little burnt out in writing about stuff for my dissertation, and I wasn't loving it. And I forget what I did first. I think a Cole Porter song, Love for Sale, that has just had an interesting history and structurally cool. And I, on a whim, started analyzing that as a, just to take a break. And then I did something on Guys and Dolls, and more my work with musical theater became where I wanted to be. And it started getting published, and I thought, okay, nobody's telling me that I can't do this anymore. Especially once I got tenured, nobody's telling you, like, but it was before I got tenured that I started working on that. So is that enough background, or do you want more?
That was perfect. Thank you so much for sharing all that. Let's circle back to your time as a student and as a grad student. So interesting to me, people who just figure out that they want to do music theory a bit earlier, because I kind of resonate with what you were talking about as far as when I started this PhD at Michigan. I was like, what is this? What is music theory? I don't know. I didn't have another plan. Kind of like you, I just like stumbled into it. It was the pandemic and I was going to graduate with two performance degrees. And I was like, oh no, okay, over there. You know, I got in and then my professors were like, okay, you're going. Don't think about it. Just move and see if you like it. And so far it's going well. I haven't dropped out. So, you know.
Don't drop out.
I like it so far. I like it. Okay. But I would love to know. So before we move on from your background, I'd love to kind of hear from your experience going through all these different degrees and following the path that you took. If you were to give a piece of advice related to writing, related to picking a dissertation topic, or related to teaching for the first time, I'd love to hear kind of from your experience so that I can benefit and other grad students listening can benefit.
Oh, you betcha. Boy, my dissertation is so boring. I mean, it is so boring. And part of that, I'll say, it comes from the fact that I wasn't an academic. I didn't have parents who were academics. I didn't go to fancy schools. And I always felt like an outsider, like I was somebody who didn't belong there. And I felt like all my colleagues were smarter than I was. I think certainly, gosh, I feel like at Eastman, I would have been voted the least likely to succeed, especially in a very daunting seminar that I had my first term there. And I felt like my writing, I was just trying to copy what I heard as academic prose. And I had gone to, you know, some SMT conferences and of course read whatever was assigned in journals. And I felt like I was trying to use the right academic words. They never felt very native to me. They still kind of don't. My most recent Spectrum article, I got criticized for it not sounding academic enough, for it not sounding highfalutin enough. So I'll show them. I'll become president of SMT. No, I never had that thought in my mind.
And the haters are listening right now, and he did it. So mind your business. Listen to another podcast.
I'm truly like still kind of astounded that I'm in this position that I'm in right now. I have friends who went to, you know, fancy prep schools and who were really, really prepared for college and really, really prepared for grad school, and I just felt like that wasn't me. So advice, I would say where I first started to write well, I think I write okay. I think I'm all right. But where I was when I started to find my own voice, and it's so hard to find your own voice, and lots of people talk about that. But for me, what that came through was giving talks. I so much prefer giving talks to writing still. Yes. And I would do anything I can in this field to make talks, podcasts, SMTV, video casts, to have the same weight for scholarship on people's CVs as articles. I think it's so important, and I think it's a more direct way of communicating. And when you give talks, you have to write differently. I'm somebody, I've experimented with extemporizing talks, but I prefer to use a script. And I call it a script because it's not a paper. So this will show you the limits of the power of the SMT presidency. If I could have, for the call for proposals, it's call for papers. I tried to make it a call for talks. And I was overruled.
Really?
So, yeah. So it's always been a call for papers, and especially given that it's a sort of joint call with AMS. Right. So I wanted to think of it. It's a talk. It's not a paper. It's a talk.
It's a talk.
And so when I give a talk, I have a script, and I highlight certain words. I use really informal language. I don't, to whatever degree I can, I don't use jargon. Sometimes you have to introduce new terms, but that's tough if you introduce too many terms. So that number one is like trying to figure out how you speak and writing in that voice. But for me, the biggest thing that helped me write was reading fiction. I heard other people on your podcast talk about reading widely. I think Phil Ewell said not to read any music theory. I'm not going to say that. sorry, Phil. I think you should totally read music theory.
Fight. Yes, this is the beef that I want. This is the drama, right. People. Yes.
But I think it's really important to read other things, to read good fiction, so that an interesting fiction. Now, it doesn't have to be like really, classics, highfalutin stuff, but I think that it's a good mystery novels, whatever. I has really improved my writing more than academic writing. The other thing is get out of your cohort. Your cohort's really, really important to you. It's your family. It's the people you connect with, and having really good colleagues in grad school is incredibly important. But it's also really important to seek out the people who are doing what you're doing at other schools.
Yes.
And hang out with them at conferences. Don't just go to SMT and hang out with your pals at the same school. Yes. Hang out with other people, meet other people. It's easier to do that now through social media than it was when I was coming up. But still, I found one of my best friends working on a similar project. He was a doctoral student at CUNY, Sean O'Donnell, I'll name him. We disagreed on a whole lot of stuff. In fact, he wrote a response to one of my articles a long time ago. And people have, I think, assumed that we were like not friends because we argued. But that's a bad assumption. it's fine. That's another thing. Don't get so dug in that you can't be friends with people who hold different views than you. So I think it's really important to just have bigger circles. And I would also say, hang out with people from other disciplines. When I started getting active in union work, when I got the job at FSU, I came in as assistant professor. I knew job one is like getting tenure, keep my head down, teach my classes, write articles, give talks, make sure I have a CV that looks like it's tenurable. And especially because with me and Nancy getting jobs together, and we went up for tenure together, that meant the stakes were even higher if either of us didn't get it. which was a little terrifying, but so get tenure. But after getting tenure, I became active in our faculty union, and that put me into a circle with people from all over the university. And I find that the work that I do right now is as influenced by conversations that I have with sociologists, with somebody in the business school, with somebody in English literature, feminist Marxist scholar, with librarians. So I my community is much bigger now, and it influences the kinds of things that I want to do in ways that I can't always articulate, in ways that aren't always very clear. But I think that it has that effect for everybody, that simply broadening your circles is good for your own breadth of research.
So let's move on. I would love to now get into your time being involved with S&T. And we can start with if there were previous positions that you've held or ways that you've been involved with S&T before the presidency. And then we can get into your time as president as well.
Oh, you betcha. I got nominated. Oh boy, I don't remember when, for a member at large, which is a great position on the executive board. I'll just say, I don't want to insult my colleagues, but it's the easiest position on the executive board, because all you have to do is opine. All you have to do is lend your voice and say how you feel about issues that come before the society. And hopefully also say the society should be thinking about this. It's just a direct opportunity to be in the room and to talk about the issues and vote on things that we need to do as a society.
Okay, I'll put the petition for Lydia as member at large in the description. Everybody, you can vote.
So the nominating committee has to nominate you. That's a structural thing. The society board members shouldn't be naming their successors.
Sure.
Right. So we have an independent nominations committee that nominates, and I didn't think anybody knew who I was, but somebody voted for me and I got on the board, and that was fun and exciting. And it was 3 years. And I think Joel Lester was the president of the society when I started. And then it was, I'm trying to remember who all I've served with in that role. Yeah, I'll think about it. and then a couple of years later, maybe, I forget exactly when, I realized I'd been a professor for a little while. I had never served on a program committee in my life. And I really wanted to see what that looked like. So I wrote to the president of SMT at the time, Lynn Rogers. And I said, I would love to be on the program committee. I understand it might not happen at this time, but I would love to do it. And then maybe a year later, she called me and said, want to be on the program committee, and would you mind chairing it the next year? They always ask one person to stay on for 2 years to chair the next year, so you can see how it works. And I said, sure. That was a lot of work. But also really, really fascinating. I mean, I felt like not since doctoral studies did I have a sense of the field. And of course, my doctoral studies, the field was much narrower than then. But to actually read everything that people are proposing to SMT was fascinating, utterly fascinating. And then I became chair of the program committee, which was probably, other than president, the most terrifying job I've ever had, because I thought if I screw up, there's no SMT program.
That's a lot of pressure.
That was like a really, really cool experience. And also the committee, we don't just vote on things, but we actually gather and we debate, especially for things that are sort of, get middling scores. It's great to be with people who are experts in different aspects of the field and chatting. It was very collegial. And it was, I felt like I got a big, big refresher course on what the field was, which had changed a lot. And then I got nominated for vice president the next year, and I somehow won that election, and I did that. And then a few years later, I was still just shocked to get the nomination as president, and I figured nobody's going to vote for me. That happened, and I don't know how it all happened, but I've been in SMT for a long time. My first SMT meeting was in 88, and I was very, very intimidated, and it didn't seem like anybody was really welcoming graduate students. Like, we had our own little cohort, but there was no like grad student breakfast. The interest groups were, I don't know if there were interest groups at the time. If there were only a couple of them.
Sure.
And so it felt like I just couldn't imagine being on the stage and like giving a talk at SMT, or I didn't know how one even became active. It was opaque to me. So somehow just going, talking to people, giving talks myself, giving lots of talks. As I said, I like giving talks more than anything else. So I proposed to SMT like every year, and I can't do it while I'm president, but otherwise I'm totally in love with giving talks, because it's performance, you know. It's
yes. Yeah. I mean, obviously, as the listeners know, I like to talk. So big on giving talks, big on the podcast. Yeah.
By the way, and so congratulations to you on being selected to be one of the plenary speakers this coming year. I can't wait to hear your talk. I am absolutely thrilled. I think that this plenary session is going to be so much more welcoming than anything that I saw as a grad student. And I heard some great talks, but I am just giddy with excitement about what this is going to be.
Thank you. Yes, I'm very excited. Listeners, it's a live show. Come to SMT. I'd love to talk to you and meet you. It'd be so fun. So yes, I'm very excited. By now, the listeners already know it's been announced and all that stuff. So, you know, we're recording this well in advance, so it will be announced. But yes, so I'm really excited. And I do feel like my experience at the annual gatherings so far, again, at 2020, I did not know what was going on. I was not fully in, I was still finishing up my master's in vocal performance at that time. And just at the same time, like typing up all of my entrance essays and all that stuff for music theory programs. So at that time, the school sponsored me to go and were just like, just go check out this music theory thing. There's a whole conference about music theory. And I was like, what? That people go to regularly? What? So I just kind of went as a spectator, and I was in the back of all the Zoom rooms, like, what's going on here? Interesting. And actually, there was a public music theory plenary that year that I really, really liked, that I thought was really interesting. Toby Rush was on it. I'm trying to think who else. Malia Jade Roberson was on it, and she has ended up coming on the podcast. Listeners, you can go back and listen to that episode. Yes, to talk about music entrepreneurship. So I do remember there being some talks that popped out of the woodwork. I was like, oh, that's really interesting, or I never thought of it that way. And I might have gone to one of the interest group meetings. So I think since then, and since 2020, I did think the accessible format was really fun. Obviously, it's very different from gathering in person. But as someone who was just kind of trying it out and wanting kind of to dip a toe in, it was like the exact thing that I needed at the time. So it definitely worked on me as someone who wasn't fully in the field yet. And since then, meeting in person, again, I virtually, 2021 was also virtual. Yes,
I believe. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So again, another kind of dip your toe in one. And so going to the conference last year, I mean, it was just crazy. Wow. Yeah. It was really overwhelming. Nobody really talks about that conference fatigue. By like Saturday, you're like, oh.
Yeah. I have to say, I introverts, I know, particularly are plagued by conference fatigue. I gain energy from it. I'm wiped out at the end of the day, but I had so much fun at that conference, and
it was fun.
It was so good to see people I hadn't seen for 3 years because of the pandemic. This next year in it's coming this year. What am I saying? This next year, this year in Denver, it's going to be another joint meeting with the AMS. But then in Jacksonville, Florida, we'll be by ourselves, and that's a more intimate conference and has a different kind of vibe to it.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so looking forward to Denver. Denver is one of my favorite cities. It'll be really, really fun. But yes, so as far as your time as president of SMT, like, what are the types of things that you do day to day? Again, obviously you don't have to reveal any gritty details, but the types of things that you work on and what you collaborate with the executive board and all of that.
Right. Good question. I would have had no idea before stepping into this position. And I can't possibly tell you like everything that I do, but I can tell you some of the things that that overwhelm me. It's almost like a second full-time job.
Sure. Oh, I'm sure.
And there's a lot of duties of the president, and possibly the biggest one is populating the committees. We have something like 30 committees, including our editorial board. So we've got four journals and lots of standing committees and some ad hoc committees. And populating those is a real challenge. And it's a challenge because you want to have diverse committees, diverse in every way that we think about diversity, diverse methodologically, diverse people. And so that's a big puzzle. And also you want to make sure that you are not just going to people you know. You want to make sure you're not perpetuating like an old boys network. So that's the president's job, is to fill the committees. Now I seek help as much as possible. And so when it's editorial boards, it's in consultation with the network, with the publications committee chair, currently Pondy Burstein. And with the various editors. And when it's other committees, thanks to Noriko Manabe's recent article in Spectrum in response to Steve Lett's article, she had a number of recommendations, and I took them to the board, and we approved a number of them. So I don't think this is even very public yet, but it's no longer me. I'm not very good about autocracy anyway. I'm a really, really bad dictator. all my union work has made me suspicious of people who have too much power, including myself. So it's now a committee of three. It's president, the vice president, currently Anya Hennigan, one of your professors at Michigan, and the president-elect, Jan Miyake. So it's going to be either the president-elect or the past president. The way that's structured, for people who don't know, president is something like a four-year term. You're only president for two of those years, but you spend 1 year on the board as president-elect, full voting member of the board, where you're basically like following along in the footsteps of the president and figuring out how it works. Unfortunately, with virtual conferences, I wasn't able to like follow along Pat Hall, who was the president before me, another of your professors. And then you spend 1 year as past president on the board so that you overlap and you can give advice to the current president. If there's, you know, because there's, hard as I will try to make sure that Jan Miyake is on board with everything, there's going to be things I forget, and it's not like you go away. Making committees now is a three-person committee. In fact, I just met with my colleagues today before this podcast recording. And we figure out, we look at the volunteer list, because if anybody who's a member of SMT can check on our membership page what committees they're interested in. And so we look at who's volunteered, and we try to make the committees as broad as possible. It just takes a lot of time, and people say no to you, and it's hard to imagine anybody saying no to me, I know, but lots of people say no. So, you just move on. That takes a long time. Preparing for board meetings. We now meet as a board every other month. Mm. It used to be just once a year, the last time I was on the board when I was vice president. And now because of Zoom, we meet every other month. And that has been wonderful. It means there's more to prepare for the president and the executive director. But we can deal with a lot of issues that are okay to deal with in a Zoom meeting. Zoom is good for some things, not so good for other things.
Sure.
And what it allowed me to do last year in New Orleans, my first year as president, was to open up a space. We have something like 12 hours of board meetings in person. And that was all occupied with resolutions and passing this and approving that and all the sort of official stuff that one has to do. And if you can knock that out in Zoom meetings, we can spend time brainstorming about where we want, what do you want the society to look like? Where can we go? What kind of difference can we make? We spent a long time talking about our budget, which sounds very boring, but I'm the son of an accountant and I can't stand like budgets and money and stuff like that. But Jocelyn Neal, our previous treasurer, routinely made the point that if you want to see a society's values, look at their budget. Mm-hmm. That boards are one thing and where they're putting their money is something else entirely. And so some of the things that I'm really proud of that we've managed to do, we have shifted a lot of the money that we give out from award winners, like publication awards, no longer carry monetary awards. They used to be just $250, which is kind of a tiny amount of money for winning like our top book prize or article prizes. And people who are winning those generally don't need that money. It pays for, a party or a good night out or something like that, but it's not going to make a difference. Whereas to a grad student, it can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so we've been shifting more and more money toward foreign travel, toward graduate student travel, toward graduate student, our dissertation fellowship, and trying to do whatever we can to foster the next generation of music theorists and to diversify the society as much as we can through that. One of the things that I'm really delighted about, I'll actually go into a controversial topic here. We had an award for BIPOC scholarship, not by BIPOC authors, but about BIPOC subjects, mm-hmm. Called the Presidential Award. And it was widely, the people who went into making it, I'm bringing this up particularly because Phil Ewell talks about it in his book. I've talked with Phil about this as well. And sometimes you do things with the best of intentions and you don't see what's going to happen. And the members of the Publication Awards Committee, which used to be one committee that did all the publication awards, had a hard time giving out an award that was on a particular subject and not feeling like it was an othering award or a second class award. That, of course, was never the intention, but we heard people, and we know that there have been years where the awardees were not very diverse. And I suspect, I don't know this, I've never actually been on a publication awards committee, but I suspect that there's often a conundrum. We have great works that come out every year in music theory, but I think that there's often a conundrum about new methodologies, new kinds of scholarship. And I think that faced with an article, a really great article about a topic form in classical music or something like that, versus something that is methodologically cutting edge, it's harder to know. It's harder to assess, like harder to compare those works. And so in a board meeting, one of the members of the board, it wasn't me, so I'm not taking credit for that, said, why do we give a single best article prize? We actually have two article prizes, one for senior, one for junior scholar. Why do we have that culture of doing that? And it was like a light shone into our virtual room at that moment. And like, why do we do that? And we thought, and with very little time, we had a resolution to expand each of our awards to 3 to 5.
Mm.
And now people don't have to make that choice anymore. You don't have to say, do I exclude this research, which is really great on Beethoven or Mozart or whatever? Both can win. And I think that that is a way of honoring what we have done in the field, but also opening up space for a lot more. And we decided to pause the Presidential Prize. So when Phil wrote his book, the Presidential Prize in BIPOC scholarship was paused, now it is gone. And the last 2 years have had, I'm really proud of the diversity of those awards. And Phil does mention the diversity from 2 years ago of the awards in his book, where he brings that up. So just to sort of update on that, I think it's been really great. We don't have any kind of quotas on it. We don't say what it should go for. We do say that we do encourage the committee to think about diverse scholarship, but we don't say what that means.
Mm.
And so that's something that I'm very proud of. And it was going to cost the society a lot of money to add more awards. We have a rather small budget. So I'll say, Society for Music Theory comes knocking at your door for fundraising. We really, really do need the money. but we thought, we don't need to monetize these awards. The value that one gets on their resume, on their CV, is so much greater than whatever value we attach to this.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of going up for tenure or anything like that, mm-hmm. but getting a job. So I'm very, very proud of that move by SMT board. There's a lot more that I'm, there's other things that are in the works that I'm incredibly proud of. I also think people have an image of music theory, of Society for Music Theory, and every major academic society as a behemoth, as something that just, it's like a ship that can't be steered because it's just too big. But it's not. And I've got a board full of activists, people who really want to make change. If you look at the membership of our board, it's people who are, it's a range of young and old. And gosh, am I the oldest person on that board? I might be. That's yeah. I don't feel very old, but whatever. I have gray hair. So yeah, it's a board that really, really wants to make a difference and really wants to make music theory more welcoming. And I feel incredibly proud of like the differences that we've been able to make just in what 2 year term as president feels like it's over just in a second. I can't believe how short this has felt. And I'm handing over the gavel really soon to Jan Miyake. And there's the daily stresses that I won't miss, but the sense of possibility is great. And I think that there's a lot of people who don't sense that. And I wish we're always looking for ways to communicate better. And I really hope that people can see that it is a society that can change and has changed a lot, and can that it's flexible. Yeah, part of the context is that I'm reading Phil Ewell's book over the summer. It's great. I'm really enjoying it. Phil is a friend of mine, and I I'm always interested to hear what he's saying, what he's thinking. I don't agree with everything in the book. That's not, shouldn't be surprising, but I think that we're coming from different places, obviously. And I think that so much of what he's written, so much of what has been written that's been critical of the field, his book, there's an issue of Theory and Practice, volume 46, that came out recently, mm-hmm. that is a series of articles that talk about how this has critiques of the society and how it can do better. The Theorizing African American Music Conference was an important part of the conversation as well. I think that there's a lot of threads, and the recent music theory spectrum, especially the symposium of responses around Steve Lett's article, mm-hmm. were also really valuable. And lots of these ideas come to the board. I bring them to the board. I suggest that we should read this article. I especially found Noriko Manabe's response so helpful. And I guess one could read them defensively, but I'm just always really happy for suggestions.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing about.
I know that veered off your question a little bit, but thank you.
That's what the show is about, tangents. That's what we're really talking about here. Okay, so to finish up, I'd love to hear just a little bit more about your involvement in union work and when you got into all of that.
You betcha. Okay, so this changes directions a little bit. I will say my first two jobs, I taught at the University of Iowa, and then I taught at Indiana University. Neither of them had faculty unions. And when I went to Florida State University, the union, I didn't actually hear about it when I first showed up. We're better now about approaching faculty. And I didn't join immediately. And then I saw we had a provost who wanted to get rid of our anthropology department. Ooh. Our anthropology department. Right.
Wow.
A department which has also been under fire, although it was years later, by our previous governor, Rick Scott, who didn't see the value in anthropology. Wow. Yeah. So the union filed a grievance. The union said, oh, no, you don't. You can't do that. We have a collective bargaining agreement. We have our contract. It's negotiated. It has the force of labor law. And they won. And the faculty who were going to be fired got their jobs back.
Gosh.
And I thought, okay, I need to be part of this group. And when Nancy and I both got tenure the same year, we thought, well, we like it. We like it at Florida State, but it's going to be awfully hard to get two tenured jobs anywhere else. So if this ship goes down, we're going down with it. I'm not suggesting that I think Florida State University is going down, but mm-hmm. we're seeing more and more challenges. We're seeing challenges right now to academic freedom, strong, sure. serious challenges to academic freedom.
Sure. It is from Florida.
From our current governor and mm-hmm. current presidential candidate. And mm-hmm. There have been laws passed. The union is fighting them. We are actively fighting them. And so I got active as just I got asked to be a union senator. So just part of the group that meets once a month. And then a colleague asked me if I would be part of the collective bargaining team. This must be 10 years ago now. Wow. And that was an experience unlike any other. I'm still part of the collective bargaining team. There's a lot of stuff that I quit. That I had to stop doing when I became SMT president, because as I said, it's like a second full-time job. I did not quit the collective bargaining team because it's means so much to me. It's so important. As I said, it's also, I'll talk about how it's inspired my scholarship as well. But this is a group of people who have become some of my best friends in the world. And together we face the administration, and there are things that limit our power in the state of Florida. It is illegal for us to strike. Unlike grad students in Michigan, we are not allowed to strike, or the union can be dissolved. It was a devil's deal before I arrived at FSU, where the right to collectively bargain was put into the Florida Constitution, but the right to strike was excluded.
Wow.
So we have that to work out, but we have other bargaining chips, and we can actually talk to the faculty. So that means that all of the terms and conditions of employment are on the table, and we can bargain them. And I'm seeing colleagues at other places that haven't gotten raises in years. We have, and we can negotiate. And it's been very, very powerful, and especially powerful right now in this very difficult time politically, where academic freedom is under attack. And we will protect the academic freedom. Our union, United Faculty of Florida, is part of the Florida Education Association. So a lot of faculty unions are AAUP, American Association of University Professors. A lot of AAUP chapters don't actually bargain. We're in the FEA, Florida Education Association, and the FEA is itself a member of both the National Education Association, which is the largest labor union in the country, and the American Federation of Teachers, the AFT. So those are the two large education unions, and also the AFL-CIO. So we are connected, and we have the resources of our national unions. Yeah. Any other questions about my union activity, or should I talk about how it's affected by scholarship?
That one, yes.
Okay. So I mentioned I study musical theater, and I love studying musical theater. It's a great deal of fun. I am really fortunate to be in a place that I get occasionally asked to do a keynote talk, and that is an honor, again, another honor that I never imagined myself having. I had a particular honor 2019. I was asked to keynote the Music Theory Society, Music Theory Midwest, which was my first regional society. I did my master's at Michigan, my undergrad at Cincinnati, and the society was just getting going at the time. And the conference was meeting at Cincinnati, my alma mater. So I actually got to give a keynote at my alma mater for Music Theory. It was great. It was absolutely wonderful. This was this is 2019, during the Trump administration. And I was asked, I think because people who were on the program committee followed me on Facebook and know how political my Facebook can be, if I would do something political. And I thought, wow. Oh gosh, I don't do anything. I don't do anything political in my scholarship. And they said that they were getting Nadine Hubbs, Dean Hubbs, to do the workshop for it. Sure. So Dean was going to talk about something political, and they wondered if I would. They said I didn't have to do it, but I thought, okay, let me think about this. And I thought, can I blend? And so I thought about, there's a number of musicals that are about labor. And I could have gone into labor songs, like songs from the Union Hall. And I thought, well, a number of people have studied that. That's more in the realm of kind of folk music and getting people to sing along and getting people to learn unionist ideologies and to fight, to learn the union history and to fight the good fights. But musical theater is a more interesting vehicle to me, because it has the ability to have sarcasm. It has the ability to have to invade in creative ways, to take audiences on a journey.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking about political musical theater. The first one that came to mind is Pajama Game from 1954, Adler and Ross. And that's a really anodyne little show. It's very sweet. It's the premise of it is, can a beautiful union steward, in the movie it's Doris Day, fall in love with the new middle management boss, who's very handsome, and when they're in the middle of a labor dispute? And the answer is, of course they can. I mean, musical theater is all about people from different walks of life or places falling in love and yeah.
Yes.
Overcoming odds. But it was really, it's a love story. It's not really, wasn't much of a unionist story. So I started looking at other things like The Cradle Will Rock of Mark Blitzstein, which was written in 1937 for FDR's Federal Theater Project. It was famously moved from its original theater on opening night. Orson Welles directed it. Very, very political. And I looked at some, at how musical structures convey a sense of discomfort, a sense of irony. And so this is like some of what I really enjoyed looking at with music theory is how does the music tell us more than just the lyrics?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what has the music got to give us at this? And I looked at that and I looked at a Harold Rome show called Pins and Needles. It was actually from 1937, actually staffed by members of the International Ladies Garment Worker Union, the ILGWU,
oh, wow.
Which was like the biggest sort of garment workers union. And it was like it wasn't really a plot driven show. It was more like a series of skits like Saturday Night Live that were all about labor, and some were sad and some were funny. There's a song called It's Better with a Union Man that, yeah. right. So you can imagine
what
that
is. I
need
to see this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did that and it was fun. You know, it was just really fun. And I, at the end of the talk, somebody asked me what I thought of Disney's Newsies. And I thought,
oh yeah, it's right there.
I didn't know Disney's Newsies. I despite living in Florida,
Wait, I'm really?
Not really. Yeah. And I once gave an SMT talk on Disney princess songs just because I was vice president at the time. And I thought, I'm never going to have this much power in ever. I'm never going to have this much cachet. I might as well just do something totally stupid. So
wait, what was the talk about?
It was about it was a kind of Shankarian, loosely about the propensity of princess songs to rise at the final cadence. This has actually become a major project of mine, looking at cadences and endings and ways that songs end. I chose princess songs just because it seemed like a funny limitation, but it's really all songs that are optimistic, enthusiastic in musical theater. They tend to rise to the final cadence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now I don't really want to include that stepwise limitation. There's all kinds of things I changed about my methodology with that, but I gave that talk, and so people asked me about Disney's Newsies, and I didn't know it, and so I educated myself. I saw the movie. I saw there's a film production of the Broadway show from 2012. And I was asked to give another talk at Music Theory Society of New York State. And actually, before that, at University of Michigan. And I talked about that and another Harold Rome show called I Can Get It For You Wholesale. It became really fun. A way of talking about union, a way about talking about politics without giving a political talk. I mean, it was a political talk, but it's a music theory talk as well. I'll say now I'm looking a lot at Great Britain. I've been studying a lot of music of a kind of workers' theater, socialist theater in London called Unity Theater, that was founded in the 30s and criticized the government in ways that wasn't allowed on the British stage at the time. But they did it because they were a private collective. And so I've been spending time in Britain recently looking at materials, and I'm probably going to, this will eventually end up in some kind of, I don't want to say book, project, something that about labor and music. But I will say, I think that right now in this time that we're in, where I have a governor who is telling us what we can and can't teach in Florida.
Yeah.
I am so glad this is where my research is right now, because the more he tells me that I can't be political in my classroom, the more I am teaching pieces of music, both classical and popular, that are inherently political.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made me realize how much of music is political in one way or another. And that the notion that you would disallow certain kinds of topics, to me is it's kind of a gift, in that it allows me to look, I have as much privilege, as much power as I am ever, as I much more than I ever thought I was going to have. And I feel so strongly now that when I'm teaching, when I'm doing research, I'm going to lean into the connections of music and politics as much as possible, especially because I'm increasingly having a government telling me that I can't or that I shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And the reason I do it is it's twofold. One, I'm a union member and the union has my back. So if I were to get fired for doing something, for teaching a political piece of musical theater or concert music, the union will have a lawsuit. The union will have my back. Second, being president of SMT, a full professor, if I got fired for political reasons, it would make the news.
Yeah.
And I would be happy to be part of that news story. I mean, I wouldn't be happy to be fired, but I would, you know, I feel like if I can't do this, if I can't say, no, I'm going to research whatever I want. I'm going to write about music that's interesting to me. Then nobody can. Cause I'm a cis white, straight white guy, who's president of an academic society. And if I can't do it, then my junior colleagues can't do it and my grad students can't do it.
Yeah.
That's the fiery end of this. But it's also, I have to say, the research that I'm doing right now gives me more pleasure than I have ever had.
And that's the thing that always comes like later on in your career, that people are always like, and after I got tenure, I started doing the things that I actually wanted to do. And it's like, oh, I wish that we could give agency to grad students and junior scholars and honor the, you know, the interests that they have when they start and make the whole process enjoyable so that they can,
but
you
we
know,
can.
Really...
But, all right, we might not be able to make it enjoyable, Lydia, but... but let me say again, it wasn't like any of my Eastman professors told me I couldn't write about musical theater. It's just that nobody had, and I didn't see it as a path toward a PhD. Mm-hmm. Now we have people writing about so much music. And I hope that if any of my students came to me and said, I want to do this, but it doesn't seem like a music theory dissertation, that I would say, make it a music theory dissertation. Because it only comes into the field. Younger people are the people who drive our field's research. It's not older people. It's I really feel like the field is whatever you all make it, and I feel like music theory has gotten very, very broad, and that's a change that I welcome with open arms. And so I have students writing dissertations on musical theater now, and I'm so happy for that. I have one student writing on intersection of musical theater and gender. So I think that there's more people writing dissertations now on things that they will continue to love than when I was in school. I hope
that would
true.
Be the hope. Yes, that's how we keep them, hopefully.
Right. But also, you know, again, you get out of grad school and you start meeting people more broadly, and it's no wonder people's interests change. And I guess I've always been a little bit envious of people who've had like one thread of research through their careers. Like they knew what they were doing. They wrote the book. I never wrote a book. I have one now that's an edited collection, but I don't have a monograph. I've gone through all of this time, but some people's dissertations just become the book, and great. I never felt ready to write the book. I'm feeling more and more ready.
There's always time.
There's time, right. But it's okay if your dissertation becomes that. It's okay if your dissertation doesn't become that.
Yeah.
And I just think that there's more and more people who are writing dissertations now that they're going to continue to research joyfully. I hope so.
Absolutely. Is there anything else that you want to make sure that we get to, or anything that you want to mention?
I guess I should have plugged my new book with Greg Decker, Here for the Hearing, which is the first book of essays, analytical essays on musical theater. Musicologists have totally owned that conversation. There's many compendiums of essays on musical theater, and there's very little music analysis in them. So I'm hoping that we're entering that conversation, and it's free. At least it's free for download. University of Michigan Press has published it, and they have an open access program that they're pushing. So you can actually go to their website and download it for free. You can also buy it. I wouldn't stop anybody from buying it, but you can see what you got for free.
Go check it out for free and then buy it.
And then buy it. Yeah.
And that is going to do it for this episode of the podcast. Thank you so much to Dr. Michael Buckler for being on the show. It was really great to hear more about what he does and more about his research. So, you know, thanks to him and other people in the society, I'm feeling really well supported as I'm new to the society. Make sure you check out the links to all of his work in the show notes. If you, dear listener, want to give me some feedback about the show, if you have suggestions for what I should talk about, some topics or some music that you're interested in that you would like to hear me talk about, if you are listening and you are interested in being a guest on the show yourself, ain't no thing, send me an email at hermusicacademia@gmail.com. Or go to my website, hermusicacademia.com, fill out the contact form there. Please tell me what you do in music. Check back in every Monday for new episodes of Her Music Academia during this fall season. Until next time, thanks for listening.